This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Equal Agenda Season 4. I'm your host, Roman, and
I'm Emmy.
And today we'll be talking about feminism and LGBTQIA plus people and theories. So I guess I know a little bit more about this one, considering I'm trans, and I guess I've just had those experiences being around a lot of different queer people. I don't know about you.
I would say I've experienced a lot of queerness in my life, I guess you could say. I was part of the Queer Straight Alliance Club in high school, which was a really cool experience.
I've been aware that there are clubs like that. There's like queer clubs and things like the Queer Straight Alliance, but I was never really active in those around high school is the thing. And I think that's mainly just because I guess it was not something that I figured out until a bit later. Although it can be a bit hard, especially just with all the information that's floating around, that like finding out your own identity can be quite difficult.
Yeah, high school's hard enough with study and like all the other stuff you have to go through, let alone figuring out who you are as a person or like your sexuality or your gender, you know?
Yeah, I mean, because I remember as well, not as much like high school, but definitely like primary school especially, you would still get bullied for being gay and stuff like that.
Yeah.
At least that's a lot of what I saw.
It's more like, for me personally, it's more about what I heard. Like gay was still, is still today, very much used as a derogatory term. Like, oh, why'd you do that? That's so gay. That's so gay. Like using it interchangeably with like dumb or stupid, which is just crazy to me that people are still doing that.
Yeah,
2026.
It is really strange because, and again, it probably comes from the association of being gay with femininity, because like there's not only is like something you dislike, you call it gay, but also if there's someone who's maybe not manly enough, you'd call them gay. You'd be like, oh, you're gay. And it's really strange because ultimately, I don't know, it's like saying you're trans, you know? That doesn't have the same weight to it because for some reason being gay has such a negative, like, association.
Yeah, and I think what's most jarring is that these kids are so young. Like, you're literally in primary school throwing around this term. And the reason that they're doing it is because that's what they hear. Like, it's just, it's a force of habit and it's like an echo chamber of repeating what maybe their parents or maybe their older siblings are, like, saying around them. And if they don't know that it's wrong, like, they don't know any better for, like, primary school kids.
Yeah, and I mean, because it enforces those ideas of that kind of toxic hegemonic masculinity where being gay is bad, being associated with femininity is bad. And those kids sort of, they get it drilled into their heads at an early age because they're using this language and they might not know the particular implications of that at the time, but it's definitely like it sinks in, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a really strong aversion to things like gayness, things like just any sort of queerness, really. It's not something that you really heard about. And even in, I remember, like, sex ed until maybe year 10, they didn't even talk about the idea of sexuality, of different sexualities, which I feel like it's a really important thing to do because it's about understanding difference, which is all around us. Like, it's not something that you can avoid. And again, with trans people, you do sort of figure that out from a very early age. I would say when I was around like 9 or 10, I started to really understand that, like, okay, I'm really not comfortable with myself, with my body the way that I am. But again, it's the lack of information. I had believed for so long that it just was not possible to be anything other than what I was. And so the realization that I could do that only came a lot later. And for many people, they believe that it's too late.
Yeah.
Right. And it's the whole thing where there are, because recently the government banned puberty blockers for like kids and teenagers that don't want to go through puberties, but obviously don't have access to things like hormone therapy because they might not be sure. And the thing is, what that does is that just denies that care to trans kids that would have had that otherwise. And, well, either they're going to go through a puberty that they don't want to, or they're going to resort to things like hormone therapy right off the bat, which can have adverse effects, unlike puberty blockers, which are just a way to delay that.
Yeah.
I think it's ridiculous. And it's not like the government hasn't tried to take the matters of queer people into their own hands, like the Stonewall riots.
Yeah.
They started mostly because the New York, what would you call them, like a council, city council? But the government at the time was going around trying to close down as many gay bars as they could.
Yeah, they were taking away the like safe places.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't want there to be places for queer people together.
Yeah.
And that takes us on to our historical figure for the day, Marsha P. Johnson.
Woo-hoo.
So she is a very well-known queer rights activist. She worked with the Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries.
Also known as STAR.
Also known as STAR. She also was active with the Gay Activists Alliance and the Gay Liberation Front. But she did, she helped found STAR, actually, as well. But a really important part of her life was her presence sort of in the Stonewall riots, which itself has actually been downplayed by some historians. But essentially what it was part of this wider sort of action by the New York City to try and close down gay bars, and the Stonewall Inn was one of them. And it was a whole, like, elaborate thing. Essentially, what happened is there was a bunch of really, like, stupid stuff with, like, regulations on, like, clothing that women could wear. If they didn't wear specific feminine clothing, then they would be not, like, taken away, but, like, you know, made to leave. And it's the same for men. Like, they were targeting specifically cross-dressers, drag queens. But eventually, a bunch of cops stormed the Stonewall Inn, and it's reported that Marsha P. Johnson was the first one to sort of, I guess, fight back. She threw a shot glass at a wall, I think, and then shouted that she had rights, and that sort of sparked the rest of the riots, which were the various queer people at the inn resisting against the police, who again were trying to kick them out, were trying to essentially erase queer culture in New York at the time. Unfortunately, she did die. They found her body washed up in a river, I believe. It was ruled suicide. Some people think she was murdered. Personally, I don't think it's all that unlikely that she was murdered. She was an activist and she was a queer person. And we still do live in a world, unfortunately, where there is a lot of violence towards queer people.
Yeah.
And a lot of that violence is related to the same kinds of violence that we have against women and girls. It's a lot of patriarchal violence.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of parallels between the violence that the queer communities face and that also like feminist women and girls face. And on the note of Martha P. Johnson, you guys get a special 2-for-1 historic figure this week.
Wow.
So I'm also going to talk about someone who I think is also it's a little bit lesser known, but just as important. So hand in hand with Marsha, Sylvia Rivera, who was a close friend of Marsha, they co-founded the STAR group, which is, if you didn't know, dedicated to helping homeless young drag queens, gay youth, and trans women in America. And yeah, so Sylvia was also fighting for very similar things. And for most of her life, she identified as a drag queen until later she came out as a transgender woman. And she participated in demonstrations with the Gay Liberation Front. So another amazing, strong fighter for the queer movement. And yeah, so there's a little 2-for-1 for you.
And it's like, because you do have a lot of trans women and generally queer people that are really, really active in fighting for the voices of not only queer people like themselves, but for women in general.
Yeah.
Like, they are very active in a lot of feminist movements, and often that's not as visible, because I feel like there is sort of like a, at least historically, a separation of the struggles of queer people and of people like women, or even in a lot of like left-wing movements, you will see a sort of exclusion of queer people.
Yeah.
Which is odd because it's, again, it's like what we talked about last episode with TERFs and excluding trans women from the sort of struggle for gender equality and feminism, where you can't really have one thing without the other. Like with workers' movements, like labor movements, where you have working class people, that requires the liberation of also women, of also queer people. Because if you're going to have a society where some people are free, but that requires the oppression of other people, that's not a free society.
Yeah. It's like we can't truly be free until everyone is. And I think, would it be fair to say that a lot of the time for like the rainbow community and the queer community, like they are often on the forefront because them themselves are often facing a lot of intersectionality, like different kind of roots of oppression in day-to-day life. So I would say that they are more open-minded and compassionate when it comes to understanding other people's oppression as well. So what I'm trying to say with this is basically like I would not be surprised that at the forefront of a lot of feminist like protest movements, so on, there would be people who are not women, like men or those who identify as like not women, then like they would still be fighting for the rights of women because they see how it is all intertwined. Like it is a bigger picture. It's easier to see the bigger picture when you can kind of relate to the experience of being held back or being oppressed yourself. Would you say that's fair?
No, I would definitely say that's fair. I think that queer people do often experience a lot of the sort of intersection of their identities. I know a lot of queer people who have experienced like poverty or racial discrimination even. And these are kinds of discrimination that often do go hand in hand. Like again, you could be discriminated against for your gender, you can be discriminated against for your sexuality. And a lot of queer people often have so-called deviant like gender identity or sexual identity and will experience discrimination for both. Often I'll see a lot of queer people characterized as like mentally ill, especially with trans people. There's a lot of discourse of like them either being mentally ill man or woman, which is incredibly insulting, but also incredibly ableist as well. And the ableism again comes in as one of the intersections of identities and disadvantage. But it's strange how this is the language that's being used against a lot of queer people and a lot of trans women who they're just being like declared mentally ill. In some places, it's an excuse to take away their rights in the US, especially putting them on like medical registers, some of the recent laws that have happened. And I'm not a gigantic fan of firearms, but they're have been attempts to take away the Second Amendment right of a lot of trans people in the US on the grounds of being allegedly all mentally ill, which again is a crazy thing to do. Is essentially you're taking away someone's right, at least in this country, based on essentially an ableist claim.
And recently in America, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not sure what state exactly, but it's now their driver's license.
Yeah, I think Kansas.
Yeah. So what's happening with that?
So what they did is essentially made it so that you have to put your assigned gender at birth on your driver's license. So no matter what your gender identity is, so if you're a trans woman, you have to put male on your driver's license. And me personally, I think that's an absolutely ridiculous change, especially because, and this is not the main reason, but this is a big reason, especially if you want to sort of work on the logic that a lot of like the transphobic activists for this legislation are working on. But driver's licenses, they're meant to identify you.
Yeah.
Like a lot of them in the United States will give things like eye color, right? Like height, weight, and various other like physical descriptions. And then you will have your picture and then those match up and everything. So if someone, like if there's a description of you put out there, people can recognize you by looking at your driver's license. Or if there's like something that's, you know, there's a discrepancy between that, then that can be identified through your driver's license. So it doesn't make sense to make a law where people have to, like people who present a certain way because of their gender identity, like trans men or trans women, are then putting something that is essentially completely adverse to what they actually present as on their identification.
Yeah, it's not who they are.
It's not who they are, and it's not what they look like either.
Yeah.
But even then, like, if I, say, have, like, a surgery to, I don't know, change my eye color or change like a physical characteristic about me, and it's not gender affirming or anything, typically those are accommodated for on licenses, right? Like, either you can have that changed to reflect what that procedure has done to you, or you can, you know, you'll have like an excuse for it. But for trans people specifically, they're limiting their ability to be able to actually like identify as the person that they are. And there are actual like penalties for this. You go to jail or you pay a fine. You like, you know, essentially what they're doing is they're imprisoning trans people for actually identifying as trans people. You essentially have to like out yourself to anyone that looks at your driver's license. It's ridiculous. Not a fan either.
It's also like a matter of safety. Like, mm-hmm. for example, say someone went missing mm-hmm. and they were trying to use that description to find them. It's not going to match what they actually look like. Yeah. And that's not who they are. So it's dangerous.
It's definitely dangerous considering the track record that a lot of police have in the US.
Yeah.
Like if they're looking for a criminal or something and they're on edge and then they see your driver's license and it doesn't match up with the way you look, they're going to be suspicious of you. And that might not go great for you especially as a queer person.
Yeah.
I think it's just, it's abhorrent. I think it's
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about some legislation happening at the moment that goes against what the queer movement stand for. We've talked a little bit about a little bit of history and a little bit of some historic figures, just very briefly. But do you want to talk about anything like personally, like how you feel or what it means to you?
I mean, definitely, I guess the process of actually transitioning. It's, first of all, practically, you've run into a lot of barriers. I think for me, it took about six to eight months to actually go from deciding to go and see someone about this to actually getting the care that I needed. And most of the way through that, you would run into either clinics or doctors that didn't know anything about the topic or were either disinterested or like actually sort of, I don't know how to put it, like weirded out. I remember going to someone to talk about this, and this, I'm not going to like name names or anything, obviously, but they just seemed really like apprehensive about everything. And then at the end of the appointment, they sort of put my name down and they were like, okay, I'll refer you to this organization. I can't really do anything for you.
Oh.
And so I left that.
Yeah.
And I never heard from anyone about anything, which was really, really weird. So I had to reach out to a different organization.
Terrible.
Yeah, no, it's actually awful. Because this, I went to a different doctor at the same clinic, and the guy was amazing. He was really nice. He was really understanding. He was even like excited for me.
Oh, that's so cool.
Which is a really nice experience to have. But at the same clinic, I had two wildly different experiences.
Yeah.
One person was essentially really cold and sort of like apprehensive about everything. And then there's another guy who's like genuinely happy to help.
Yeah.
I think.
And I guess we'll talk about this a little bit next week with our medicine episode, mm-hmm. but I would kind of infer that, I would guess that that would be because, well, I don't know their own like thoughts and beliefs, those doctors, but I guess in the medical field, it's very based on like your sex and like how that in terms of autonomy and body, like it's very black and white in the medical field. Like they're not taught about the concept of gender. They're not taught how that plays a part in society. I'm hoping nowadays a bit more, they're learning a bit more cultural responsibility and a bit more kind of compassion, I guess you could say. And I'm not saying that this is for all doctors, but I've also experienced a little bit, not that obviously not the same experience, but just that kind of coldness of like, it's just another day's work for them, mm-hmm. but it's actually the patient's like life. But I won't get into that too much because we'll definitely talk about that next week.
No, I definitely get what you're talking about. I really do think that, especially with professions like medicine, where you are actively taking a part in people's lives and well-being, that there should be more of an inclusion of things like the humanities in a lot of the different sciences, because you will have a lot of people who may be really good at a particular field in sort of STEM, but they have next to no contact with the humanities. They don't like anything like sociology or psychology or anything like that. And you can sort of see how that reflects in their interactions with other people, and especially with doctors, is that they, half the time you will run into a doctor that you just don't feel comfortable around because they don't have that sort of understanding about people, about more complex social issues. And especially teaching medical professionals about just being conscious of other people's experiences, of being conscious of things like gender and sexuality, because a lot of even like queer youth, I think it was I can't remember the exact statistic, but it was like a significant proportion of queer youth are afraid to actually go and visit a doctor because they're afraid of the sort of reactions that they'll get. They're afraid of being judged. They're afraid of being dismissed.
Yeah.
And it's horrible because it's not exactly denying care to these people, but just like as a proxy, just by the way that these institutions behave, it turns away queer youth. It turns away trans people and gay people and lesbians. It's really awful.
Yeah. And it would be so scary to have someone who's like supposed to be like a safe place to go. Like when you're brought up, you're kind of taught, oh, you know, doctors are there to help you and like police are there to help you. But all of a sudden when you become a part of this community, it's almost like they become a place of fear or a place of like unsafety. Not safe. What's the correct grammar there? I'm not sure. But just kind of want to quickly talk about something else a little bit. Have you noticed personally any connections, because I know I have, but between LGBT theory and like what it is to be queer and the connection to that in being a feminist and like what it is to be a woman? So just any personal experience you've had with that, because I can also share, but you can.
I mean, I think it really helps you understand sort of the, especially intersectionality and the intimate connection between different struggles for different people. So for me, growing up, gender has always been sort of a strange thing to me. Like, it's not always made perfect sense. And so I guess that leads to me having naturally questioned assumptions about gender and about norms and expectations surrounding it. And that, I guess it really helps with understanding the sort of critical theory behind that. Like, queer theory came from like the post-structuralists like Foucault, and it comes with a questioning of gender itself. It's like, because it is a social construction. A lot of the expectations and norms around gender are just made up, and they vary from place to place. And even with like sex itself, like biological sex, is we know from the experiences of intersex people that it's that itself is not a binary. It's not as rigid as would be believed. And yeah, so my experience being queer, growing up questioning and being a part of queer communities, I think has really helped me understand that the ways in which gender is constructed in a way to benefit patriarchy and to disadvantage women, and that a lot of work still needs to be done to achieve gender equality and to actually achieve women's liberation. Because even though we have a lot of protections codified into laws, actually recently France codified protections for abortion and stuff like that and women's bodily autonomy in their constitution, which I think pretty much every country should be doing. But beyond that, beyond it just being written into law, there are social attitudes that need to actually change.
Yeah.
And it's why I still think it's so important to be a feminist and so important to actually engage in this, is because there's a long way to go, I think, still.
Yeah, 100%. I think I've also definitely noticed some similarities, or in terms of like, I've definitely noticed in my life some ways in which the patriarchy has definitely impacted like my sexuality, like in terms of like how it relates to queer theory and stuff. So I don't really like to use labels, but I've definitely like been attracted to girls as well as guys. And I remember the first time that I had a crush on a girl, I like thought to myself, nah, like you can't, because no one's going to believe you. They're just going to think you're doing it for attention, or like because I dated guys before, they would just think that it was kind of like a weird phase. And I guess it kind of prevented me from pursuing anything with this girl. But now looking at it and all that I know from sociology, I would definitely say that that is kind of a patriarchal structure to not believe women. Yeah. And I've definitely seen stuff before, like on media, about in particular people who maybe identify as bi, and like people not believing them and just kind of saying, in particular for bi women, just kind of saying, oh, you'll eventually be with a man, like this is just a phase. And it's just definitely that kind of dismissiveness of women's emotions and women's feelings, and just dismissing the importance of them, if that makes sense.
No, I definitely get that. And that's very important to include, especially because bi people's identities have often been sort of I guess attacked in the way that there's an assumption that you have to be either one thing or another. Like if you've had relationships with men, then you can't also have relationships with women in the same sense. And I think it's just a ridiculous thing, because in a lot of places and cultures across time, bisexuality has been the norm. Rome, the Roman Empire, is a really big one where bisexuality was expected even. And so it's a very modern concept to even like just being gay, but either being like straight or gay. It's a ridiculously rigid thing, and it prevents people, I think, from pursuing relationships that they might have been really happy in.
I think that often as well, people who, this is a generalization, but people who are homophobic are also sexist. They go hand in hand.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that a lot of homophobia comes from, like, for example, people who are bi, people who are homophobic towards them. It's because being queer goes against the patriarchy as well. So in particular, people that enjoy the patriarchy and benefit from it are going to be more wary and cautious and like fearful and against the stuff that are going against it and fighting for what it doesn't stand for. So that's, I guess, in a nutshell, why feminism and LGBTQIA plus theory go hand in hand. But
exactly. That's really all we have time for this episode. Again, as always, there's a lot more that we could have talked about, I think, and there's a lot of different things to think about. So we encourage you to let us know in the comments about anything that you might have found that we could have included, that's something that we might have missed, or just generally your thoughts on this. It's a very broad topic and it's very interesting.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to reach out to organizations like Inside Out or Rainbow Youth. They're here to help and we really recommend them.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.